laser thingy. I was just trying to figure out if the nice laser pointer part of this worked.
Top right.
Top right. All right, never mind. So I'm Brett Hartle. I'm the Endangered Species Policy Director for the Center for Biological Diversity. But most of this talk actually comes from work I did as the Senior Policy Fellow at the Society for Conservation Biology. I just switched jobs a few months ago. And I apologize, I'm getting over a little bit of a cold, so see how well my voice holds up. I want to just give the, I'm an environmental attorney as well, so I'm going to give you the 30-second version of the difference between guidance and regulations. Guidance, which is how the Fish and Wildlife Service and NIMS does recovery planning, is optional. It's sort of the encouraged approach, but it's not required. Regulations are legally binding requirements, and I will argue that we need some minimums to ensure that recovery planning doesn't go off the rails. So, okay, that top line says, why are recovery regulations needed? This is a quote from a recent Inspector General's report looking at a set of actions from the Bush administration. So there's definitely going to be, you know, politics that comes into this. But I would just point out the last line. There is a value in having a fair and consistent application of rules when it comes to these types of decisions, because they implicate a broad, broad suite of species, and inconsistency has problems. They actually tie into things like resources, you know, litigation. My organization does bring a lot of lawsuits, but they are drains on resources, and having a transparent, consistent approach can help minimize that. Okay, so Dan talked about this a little bit, so it was great. I can kind of skip over it. One of the most central questions is, what is recovery? The ESA sort of gives us an answer. If you look to the purpose, there's an ecosystem component. Conservation says get to the point that the ESA is no longer needed. So the Fish and Wildlife Service does have a regulatory definition for recovery. It's the top one there, and it says once a species no longer needs the provisions of the Act, it's recovered, which is correct. It is not that helpful. It's a tautology. But I will note that the recovery guidance that Debbie talked about does mention the ecosystem component expressly. So there is something besides just getting out of that emergency room stage that does potentially matter for recovery work. And I will talk about wolves because they're obviously very current. This is what Director Dan Ash said about the decision to delist the wolf. He said, science is an important part of this decision, but really the key is the policy question of when is a species recovered. And I kind of agree. I think there are lots of policy questions wrapped into the idea of recovery. So the question is, which policy questions are sort of consistent with the goals and purposes of the ESA, and when are policy considerations that might not be appropriate brought in? And how do we keep sort of the bad policy factors from influencing decisions while we recognize that there are legitimate policy questions involved in recovery? And of course, you know, wolves, they're current, so it's a good thing to talk about. One of the aspects, and I'll come back to wolves in a second, and unfortunately this crazy line is here, I don't know how to get rid of it, is the geographic scope of recovery. So these are maps from a paper published in Bioscience that show that there have been major range contractions over, you know, the historic time. Many of these species are listed, so grizzly bear, wolf, eastern cougar, which may be delisted at some point because it's considered to be extinct, lynx, wolverine is currently being proposed for listing, and questions about where we draw the line in terms of geographic extent of recovery is an important question to ask. And the other question, of course, is abundance. So how many individuals do we need to get back up to where we're at recovery? So no one knows the exact number of wolves in the lower 48, but there were probably over 100,000. We're right about, you know, 5% right now. And I think everyone recognizes we'll never get back up to 100,000 wolves, but where in that range is recovery actually? Does recovery occur? Ah, yeah, that damn line. So this is a potential wolf habitat in the lower 48. This map actually comes from the Fish and Wildlife Service. I got it through a Freedom of Information Act request. It's a very current map. It shows areas where they think there's still suitable habitat based on ecoregion analysis and all these different factors. And you can see there's areas in the Northeast, along the West Coast in California, Colorado and Utah, chunks of Texas. All of those areas do not have wolves right now. They certainly could. It's all suitable habitat. But in the decision to delist the wolf, they said, we do not need wolves in those areas to meet recovery. We have achieved recovery. And I'm not going to get too much into the why that's bad or good. I'll just say that it is something to consider is geographic extent. And how do we fully deal with that? This is a study from Miley Neal. She looked at 1,000 plus recovery plans. From an abundance perspective, if you look at numbers of individuals, the recovery targets are on the low side. If you look at numbers of populations needed to achieve recovery, populations are really on the low side. So these are questions about how many... recovery is all about how much is enough. So right now, a lot of these plans, even the current ones, it's pretty low. And I'll give credit to Miley Neal here. This is her graph as well. I poached it. I think there's a conception in most people's mind that this is sort of the pattern of recovery. A species is somewhat abundant. It goes through a major crash. We list it. We develop a recovery plan. And then it gets on the trend towards recovery. And when we're getting close to that sort of historic abundance, we're at the delisting stage. For rare species, so that's a robin cinquefoil. It was delisted a couple years ago. It was always rare. It declined. It came back. So there's a pattern that I think people perceive where, you know, we get kind of close to where we were historically. Other examples cut off by that random thing, peregrine falcon, bald eagle, brown pelican. Recovery was basically achieved when they were back at about their historic abundance. But in reality, recovery often is far, far less than where they were historically. Two examples to take away from the wolf for a second. Grizzly bears, black-footed ferrets. I think most of us acknowledge there will never be grizzly bears wandering the entire Great Plains again. If they're a very difficult species to recover, they need large home areas, unfragmented habitat. Black-footed ferrets faced a suite of threats, including plague. We will never really get rid of it because it's invasive, the pathogen. So delisting is going to probably happen at a lower level. And the question is, how much of the line between where we think recovery should be and where it actually is, are there relevant policy questions that should be decided? And how much of that flexibility should there be, and should there be any limits on it? So I wrote a petition for the Society for Conservation Biology asking the Fish and Wildlife Service to create a regulatory framework for recovery. I'll say this is mostly my idea. It's not perfect, but I thought we ought to have a slightly more robust definition of recovery. Under U.S. law, any citizen can write a petition to their government asking them to create new regulations. I encourage you to do it. It's kind of fun, if you like that sort of stuff. And I think actually I agree with Debbie in a lot of these things. We believe that there's no good reason to not always include the three R's, representation, resiliency, redundancy. Why not say all the time that those should be in every recovery plan? We would probably disagree about historic range and other things, but I think we would all agree that you should consider all of the threat factors every time. So it's a long petition. You can read it on the SCB website. I'm just going to highlight a few kind of key things. That was my idea of geography or of recovery. It includes things like significant portion of the range. Dan mentioned that concept. It's quite confusing. If you want to learn more, ask me later. But geographic extent matters. The second component is, of course, downlisting and delisting. So Dan mentioned that there's two categories. You have endangered and threatened. The question is, should criteria be the same for each category? In other words, if you're endangered and you're going down towards threatened, do you need a different set of criteria than when you're going from threatened to recovered? I would argue yes. So for downlisting criteria, again, I apologize for that. We basically focus on a lot more quantitative analysis. You could even do PVAs. There's a threat abatement component. I threw out an arbitrary number of a 10% extinction risk over 100 years is where you could draw the line between endangered and threatened. It's just a number. That the services don't actually ever state that there's a, you know, one right answer. And I did this for the downlisting from endangered to threatened because in this category, you're still protected. We're just saying at some point you can go from the highest level of protection to a slightly lower level of protection, and we think there could be a uniform threshold without having any real adverse effects to species. Now, for delisting criteria, we took a slightly different approach, which was to note that delisting should consider the ecosystem function of species. In other words, going back to the purposes of the ESA. So I tried to kind of get that in there by saying, where it is, did I not give the right paragraph? Anyway, I'll come back to that in a second. So the idea is, how do you quantify ecosystem function? So CITES, which is the Convention on International Trade in Endangered Species, which the ESA implements, so it's part of the ESA's to implement it, has a similar idea that you should protect species to make sure that they are functioning in their ecosystem. Now, how do you figure that out? Well, Soule says you should think about things such as ecosystem engineers, things that have, you know, trophic effects, things that are that have measurable criteria that affect their ecosystem. And in fact, the Fish and Wildlife Service did this in the case of the sea otter. They said that one of the recovery criteria should be a certain amount of kelp-dominant habitat that's sort of created by the fact that there are sea otters there. So we think it's important to think about how the species relates to its ecosystem in terms of recovery. It can't just be about the numbers. It has to be about that broader focus. And I just throw this in there because I kind of like the idea. I really give credit to the Fish and Wildlife Service. They did this amazing thing for Nahoa Miller bird, which is in the Northwest Hawaiian Islands. They're limited to one small island. As part of the recovery plan, they introduced them to another island where there's an extinct species of Miller bird. So it was a perfect fit to say, hey, there used to be a Miller bird here. We want to give the species more protection. Let's create a new population in an area where we know there was an ecological analog. They did this in Aldabra and Mauritius with giant tortoises, recognizing that species have roles for ecosystems. And, you know, we think it's important that that be considered in recovery planning. There will always be discretion in how the services do it, but we don't want them to ignore it completely. Okay, so really quickly turning gears towards the nuts and bolts of recovery planning. Spotted owl, when they did the recovery plan, there was a lot of political interference to the point that the original recovery team didn't have owl experts. That could be a problem. So we said in our petition that recovery teams, if the Fish and Wildlife Service creates them, should have at least a few experts. You don't have to have everyone being an expert, but you ought to have a few. And when you get to this from a resource perspective, if you have a terrible plan that has no owl experts and the Center for Biological Diversity will sue in that situation, that's a waste of resources and time from the Fish and Wildlife Service perspective. So if you keep those minimums in place, you might be able to avoid some of those problems. Recovery teams, so Carlos Carroll, who organized this symposium, has been part of the Mexican wolf recovery team. They have been trying to create a recovery plan for the Mexican wolves on and off, different people, since the early 2000s. And it's been stalled because of politics. And I recognize that wolves are political, but that's a waste of resources from Fish and Wildlife's perspective. If you're doing recovery planning for over a decade and you have nothing to show for it, that's a loss of resources. So if for some reason your team can't come to a decision within a set period of time, it goes back to the agency, they finish the recovery plan on time. It saves everyone money, there's an incentive to get the job done and not sort of stall out the process. Dan also talked about this case having to do with whether or not Fish and Wildlife Service has to follow their recovery guidance. There's another part of the act which requires the services to do a status review every 5 years. And this case says, well, if you have a status review that says the species is recovered, you don't have to necessarily meet the recovery plan guidance. Fine. So maybe we need to improve our status reviews. And we gave some language on how to do that. The idea being, if you do a 5-year status review and you determine that your recovery plan is out of date, don't just say it's out of date, but offer sort of suggestions of how you might fix it. I'm sort of running out of time, so I can't go into the details, but I will give a couple examples. Hawaiian hawk, there was a 1984 recovery goal. It was never updated. In 2007, they did one summer of surveys. they concluded that they had reached the 1984 recovery goal. The 1984 recovery goal was just the population at the time of listing. There was no other data available. So they've done one status review. It's been 7 or 8 years, and the official plan is that we might delist it in 2014, but there's been no intervening 5-year status review. So should you be able to use now a 6 or 7 year old status review to delist if you haven't done another one, if you're not keeping up to date? Another example, California lease turn. Again, an early recovery goal was just based on a number. The services have done a great job in getting the population much higher through really intensive population management. But they recognize that there are threats out there and that the recovery criteria are not sufficient. And if you read the most current status review, it says that. But it actually doesn't say what those new recovery criteria ought to be. Now, I would agree that maybe it's not the best use of your time to create a whole new recovery plan. But maybe in the status review, you could say, we think these threats are the ones we need to address. These are the criteria that they ought to have. And sort of our language on how you would do a status review as sort of the minimum floors would say things like, you should look at, you know, whether the recovery goal is still current, whether the delisting and downlisting goals are still current, and things like that. So Carlos is going to probably want me to leave. I encourage you to read the whole petition, and I'll be happy to take questions at the end. Thanks.